Free Oklahoma. We have calling guest James Corbett actually calling in from Japan. It's now 10 a.m. local time. And Mr. Corbett, he runs the actual Corbett Report, which provides podcasts, interviews, articles, and videos about breaking news, important issues from 9/11, as well as truth and false flag terror to the Big Brother and police state, eugenics, geopolitical, and central banking and fraud and more. So welcome to Radio Free Oklahoma. Glad to have you here.
I am glad to be here. Thank you.
Biometrics and the smart grid and issues of sovereignty, and he covered ClimateGate, and he's got a YouTube channel as well that is that's going great.
Yes, it's certainly I've been taking off recently, and it's really humbling for me to see how far my voice is spreading, and I'm just honored to be part of helping to spread the information, which is the most important thing. But first off, I just want to apologize in advance if I suddenly have to leave the conversation, but just part of my quotidian daily life here in Japan. Apparently, there's a plumber who may or may not be coming to fix my leaky toilet here in my apartment, so if I have to step away for a moment, I hope you'll forgive me.
We will. We definitely will.
So where could people find your work? Is this CorbettReport.com? Is that correct?
That's right. CorbettReport.com. And also, all of my videos can be seen on YouTube.com/CorbettReport. And there's also an independent YouTube called Veracity Videos that I have posted some of my videos on, and I intend to post all of them eventually, but it's just a time-consuming process. But I want to help support those sites that are trying to get an alternative to the mammoth sites like YouTube that, of course, is just Google in disguise.
Well, we certainly want to thank you for your attention on the Oklahoma City bombing case. You know, there's not a lot of people covering that, and we're honored that you would take the time to go through and expose people to the truth about that incident.
Well, when you look at the major false flag operations that have happened in the last 20 years, I think Oklahoma City is in some ways the most glaringly obvious when you start to look at the discrepancy between the coverage that was happening at the time and the things that have leaked out gradually in that, you know, drip drop of information coming out a bit at a time over the course of a decade and a half. And the discrepancy between that and the way that people think of what the overarching narrative of that operation was is just so vast. I can't see how anyone who was being intellectually honest wouldn't be able to see just what an obvious example that was of false flag operation.
That's episode 38. Oklahoma City was an inside job. And I think I mentioned that he pulled up a lot of news clips that I hadn't heard for a very long time. And it brought back a lot of memories for me in noticing the discrepancies at the time, like the fact that you pointed out, and I think I may have lost this little bit of information in my head, that that even on the federal level, that they had confirmed that they actually did find bombs. And I remember seeing on TV the little bomb units going up there, clearing everybody out at least two or three times. And you had all of that laid out in that number 38 episode. And I said, I think that it is a really good base for just going back and remembering, if you wanted to further study into it, that episode would be really good to start with.
Well, that would be something good for our listeners to go and check out if you want to get, you know, some of this foundational information, being as we just had the 15th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing.
James, would I, if you don't mind, I'll interject here real quick. One of the gentlemen that was on the news clip that you featured on your episode 38, a gentleman by the name of Devin Skilly, and he was actually the PM anchor for Channel 4, which was the NBC affiliate here in Oklahoma City. He was woken out of his sleep. He was up till about 2 doing the broadcast the night before. He was literally in bed when it happened, rushed down to the studios, joined hand-in-hand with the AM anchors to broadcast what was going on. And he already had a contract signed to move to Detroit with, oddly enough, Channel 4 of NBC up there. He's the PM anchor up there. And that contract was signed about 45 days in advance of the bombing. So some folks said, well, he wrote on the coattails of his notoriety, 15 minutes of fame. That wasn't true at all. I had a meeting with him back in July of 2007 at a barbecue restaurant about 4 blocks from his studio in downtown Detroit, right on the river there. And he shared with me, he says, look, he says, I know there was more to this case. Every time people will email him, or he'll once in a while pull up the old newscast of him, they're actually broadcasting this information. I handed him a copy of the final report, which is put together by the Oklahoma City Bombing Investigation Committee, and it says, this is a good source book. It quotes you verbatim on what you said that morning. And he called me back about a month later. He says, look, I can't take part in your movie, but he says, I do appreciate what you guys have done over the years. And this is coming from a guy that was there that morning in studio broadcasting the news. He knew that there's a lot more to the story. And he gave us a two thumbs up on what we're doing. But that actually trickles down to your work. And if it wasn't for you, this story, people like you, the story would be dead and gone and in the memory hole. And that's why we appreciate what you're doing.
Well, that is an absolute honor to hear, because this is exactly what I'm trying to do, is just to try to get out the source documents and things that show that the narratives we're being fed are completely skewed and lacking context that would make them useful as sources of information. And it's really fascinating for me to hear a story like that, because obviously not being in Oklahoma, I don't really have access to sort of the local inside scoop on the stories and the people who are reporting them, but it's really fascinating to hear that. And it only further validates what we already know about a lot of the people who had some connection to the case and have said that it's not what it appears, including, of course, Cop of the Year Terry Yeager, who ended up committing suicide in an extremely extravagant manner that absolutely defies all credulity. But he was one of the cops on the scene, one of the heroes dragging people out of the building that day, who said that there was that the story was not what it appeared to be, and he was on the verge of coming out with something that would help to debunk the myth of Oklahoma City, and ended up committing suicide in a field in a way that absolutely
you described
could not
that very
played.
Well, very extravagant way, very unbelievable, and that story, and also the Trinity story, keeps bringing information out.
He had slashes to the wrists with grass in him, bled out in the car, and then apparently tied a rope around his neck and drug himself almost a mile through brush under fences, out into a field, and then held the weapon so far away from his head that it left no powder residue, and then after he shot himself, pitched the gun so far away no one could find it for hours. So, yeah, I mean, if you believe that was suicide, you might want to go check out tytruth.com to get the full story. This is the site that the family has put together that has the real story about what happened around his death, and also gives you folks an opportunity to donate to the legal fund to try to get some justice for this true hero.
Now, this is a story that no lawyer really seems to be willing to take. They might initially be sort of agreeable to it, and then once they look into it, they don't want anything to do with it. So there has been no justice for this family. There's been no real investigation, and that's something that we hope to rectify.
James, I can speak firsthand that we've approached four attorneys, we and certain members of Terry's family over the last 7 years, four attorneys here in town. They refuse to return phone calls or have their secretaries give us the dossier that we handed them with the seal not even broken on the envelope. They don't even want to touch this. And a fifth attorney was a former, in fact, he sat on the Carol Howell case. He was a former U.S. District Judge, Western District of Oklahoma out of Tulsa. Sat on the bench for, I believe, 14 years. He is in private law practice now in a town about an hour and a half south of here, and he also has an office in Oklahoma City. He won't even touch this case. That's how volatile and bad it is, even 14 years on. May 8th will be 14 years to the day that Terry passed away. And I can only say this, but I met with two of the sisters and some family members this morning on the case. So for anybody who thinks that case is dead and gone, it's you do a 180. This thing is alive, and they're still pursuing the truth. And I tell you what, I would not want to meet these people in court. They are after this with a vengeance.
As they should be, absolutely. This is such an important aspect of the case in general and the system in general. And one of the recurring themes on my podcast episodes is called Requiem for the Suicided. And I've had one episode about Gary Webb, the reporter who broke the CIA drug running scandal and the crack cocaine epidemic in the 90s. And I've talked about his very suspicious suicide, and there's no doubt I'll also be covering Terry Yeager in a future episode.
I actually lived in L.A. when all that stuff was unraveling, when the director of the CIA actually came to Los Angeles to address the allegations. And, Gary Webb, what was it, twice? He shot himself twice in the head?
Yes, twice in the head, right?
With a shotgun?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, that's episode 117, and I listened to that. I think I sent Chris a link for that, because it's one of the best episodes in boy, it really tells the story in a way that you can't turn away
from
it.
He had exposed the CIA was trafficking cocaine into South Central Los Angeles, and they were turning it into crack. That was at the beginning of the marketing campaign that I remember as a young man. That every channel I turned it on, it was like crack cocaine. It's cheap. It'll get you high. We mentioned it's cheap, and it'll get you high. It's real cheap. It's called crack cocaine. It's new, and it'll get you really high. Over and over and over again, just drove into everybody's head.
And, absolutely.
Wait a minute. Was this done in sarcasm or the real thing?
No, I mean, every newscast.
Kept advertising it, essentially, in talking about it.
They were bringing it in. The CIA was bringing it in and then taking the profits from that to send to buy weapons to send to the Contras.
Sure.
Right. And anyone who doesn't realize how the media is complicit in that by hyping it and talking about it as being delusional, because obviously that's part of what feeds into the whole system in general.
But see, the people in Los Angeles knew what was going on because they know they don't have any planes. They don't drive to South America and pick this stuff up.
Right.
It's got to come from somewhere, you know. And Freeway Ricky Ross spent years in prison while Oliver North got a TV show on Fox. I mean, it's ridiculous.
He's running for governor of Virginia. Go figure. Oh, boy. we're going to be coming up on break. This is a great interview. We've got so much to cover here with James Corbett. With CorbettReport.com, based out of Japan. And I'm very interested. We're going to talk in the next segment what actually got him started on this.
Yes.
And why, what brought him to Japan and so forth. This is Radio Free Oklahoma. You're listening to the Rule of Law Radio Network. And we'll be back in just a moment.
Welcome back to Radio Free Oklahoma on the Rule of Law Radio Network. We're speaking with James Corbett of the CorbettReport.com. And we were talking a little bit about Officer Terrence Yeakey. And I believe that we have a caller on the line that is involved with some of the investigation here. Joe Cooley is on the line. Joe, how are you doing?
Well, just fine. Thank you, James.
Did you have a question for Mr. Corbett?
Well, how Mr. Corbett got involved in this?
Well, in Oklahoma City specifically, or just with the website?
Yes.
In general?
Yes.
In general?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Well, basically, I was about 3 or 4 years ago that it was a very mundane event in my life. I just moved into a new apartment here in Japan, which came with an internet connection. So it was the first time in years that I'd had an internet connection in my home. And basically, I just started. It was in the intervening years between the time that I had not had an internet connection and the time I got one again. Things like YouTube and Google Video had cropped up, and it was just such an incredible paradigm shift in the way that I was being able to collect information on things that I actually cared about, as opposed to what the corporate media was trying to tell me I should care about, so that I could basically think of a subject and type it in and find out more information about it. And that was so revolutionary for me that it was not long before I started encountering the type of information that I think I would never have encountered in a million years if I had been doing this in a pre-internet age. And that's what started me on my quest. And it wasn't long before I started finding things like the original news clips of the original Oklahoma City bombing news broadasts and things, which pointed to huge discrepancies in the story. So it was really just a process of starting to find the information for myself.
Okay, and what area, like particularly of the Oklahoma City bombing, interests you the most?
I'm not sure if there's any one area I could point to, but certainly I found it extremely interesting about the multiple bombs being found in the building that day that, of course, we never hear about anymore. I also found General Ben Pardon's testimony about the blast and the way it occurred and how it could not have possibly come from the ammonium nitrate fuel oil bomb. I found it interesting that the surveillance tapes had been confiscated and were not being released. And, of course, we saw them released last year, but conveniently missing the actual actual explosion itself, as was expected. So just every single thing that I investigated in regards to that bombing seemed to bring up more questions than it answered.
What was the absurd excuse they used that all the tapes in all the various buildings around the area were all being changed at the exact same time? How amazing.
Maybe McVeigh knew about that, and that's why he chose that moment.
Yeah, it's Go ahead, Joe. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's true. And why is the Central Intelligence Agency, fighting tooth and nail in court to prevent the release of these tapes? I think that says everything right there.
Absolutely. You know? And we see the same thing with 9/11 and the Pentagon. We know there are more tapes of whatever hit the Pentagon, and they're not releasing those. So it's the exact same thing. If it bolstered the story, they would release it.
Any other comments or questions, Joe?
I guess not.
I guess okay. You got cut off.
All right, okay. Joe. Well, we appreciate you calling in. All right, Mr. Corbett, so you've kind of covered what got you started here. And so you didn't really have access to the internet, and you went straight from going through an experience that I hear a lot of us talk about. You know, I believe Gary Franchi put it best at a conference I heard him speaking at. He said he got a little bit of the truth and then locked himself in his basement for 2 weeks and deprogrammed himself watching, you know, Alex Jones videos and you know.
Sounds like something. Yeah, I do.
So, absolutely. I mean, it's a common experience that you know, we all have in our awakening, but you really, you know, kind of took it to the different level, you know, doing these reports, these podcasts, these news podcasts.
Right. Yeah. And that's something that I stress as much as I can on my podcast and in the work that I do, is that I never in my entire life had any interest whatsoever in starting any sort of media outlet or starting a blog or starting a podcast or doing anything remotely like this. But once I started to encounter this information and the enormity of what I was encountering hit me, I wouldn't have been able to look myself in the mirror if I wasn't doing what I could to get the information out to other people. So
Exactly.
There's nothing you can do once you start to realize this information is out there, that you just have to start spreading it yourself.
I mean, I think all of us would, you know, much rather be able to just spend our time in leisure and, you know, I'd like to go to the lake and do some fishing and, you know, but whenever you realize the truth and you realize that there's not that many other people out there talking about it, you're compelled. You have no choice but to go out and tell other people you're being lied to.
Exactly. I mean, that's really what motivates me, and absolutely, obviously, I spend an incredible amount of time on the website, especially considering I have a regular 9-to-5 job as well. So, it's something that I've consciously made the decision. I have to sacrifice other areas of my life in order to get this information out there. And it's, so it is humbling to know that I am having an effect. But it's obviously what I'm trying to do is just help other people learn what I've encountered along the way. And I'm not asking anyone to agree with everything I say or believe everything I say, quite the opposite. I just want people to start examining these source documents and thinking about the questions for themselves.
That's one thing we have in common. You really, you always provide documentation. And, you know, back when we were in the throes of that pandemic, it was funny. I was in South Carolina for several weeks and kind of cut off from the internet as well. And so I couldn't connect with you or anyone else. And so what I did was I went and bought a couple of books on the 1918 flu. And lo and behold, when I came back and listened to your podcast, we had sort of a convergence of our studying, because you told the story that I found so interesting about them going out and digging up the Inuit Indians to get those samples and the manner in which they did it. Did you know that the army, the military was racing the one fella to get there first, and he was trying to hold out for some funding and realized that the military was taking the information he was applying to the military for funding, and they were literally racing out there to dig up the Inuit Indian. But that story, you're right. One thing you pointed out, you covered that pandemic. I would encourage everybody to go and check that out. Check out the pandemic coverage, the vaccination coverage, and the one on BPA that you did recently, James. You would really like that. Mm-hmm. But that story was interesting because they were not doing it for research to help with flu. And I can remember watching TV and seeing maybe on National Geographic or something, why are they digging that up? I mean, it's a terrible thing. And he was wanting to do it just to basically get a name made for a process that he had perfected of extracting DNA and RNA from really, really you know, badly degraded tissue. But it was just awesome to turn you on and hear that and know that we had that convergence. And I've been real curious as to how you came to be in Japan.
Exactly. What brought you across the pond?
Well, I guess it was 6 years, 1 month, and 3 days ago that I washed up on the shores of Japan. And I was basically just looking for a way to spend a year traveling around Asia, seeing what I could see. And I decided the best way to do that would be to just get a job teaching English and travel in my spare time. So I came out here 6 years ago for 1 year, but obviously that turned into 6 years, and there's no time in the near future where I'll be returning to my home country of Canada. So I'm obviously enjoying it out here. It's a wonderful country in so many ways.
I can tell that you like it there, and you know, I was curious. I thought that he seems very intelligent, and I wondered if maybe at the vantage point that you're at, if it's harder or easier for you, because you do a really good job of putting the information in context, and that's something not everybody is good at. You do a really good job of putting it in context, and so I wonder in Japan if maybe you're not helped a little bit by your vantage point.
Well, thank you for that comment, and yes, I struggle with this sometimes. I wonder, because obviously the nature of what I'd be doing, it would be quite different if I was in Canada or in America. And obviously just by the proximity to the events, I'd be covering them in a different way. But I do think that I do have a certain advantage to being completely unplugged from the mainstream media matrix in North America. And so I'm not subjected to that that bombardment of propaganda every time I turn on a TV or a radio. So that does help give a certain perspective to things. So when I encounter media clips or whatever, it's through, you know, video sharing sites and things like that. So I have a certain disconnect that does help me to have a certain perspective. But at the same time, I'm not able to get the live interviews or to do as much culture jamming or other types of activities that We Are Change is doing and things like that I'd like to be involved in, but just no real opportunities to do that here in Japan.
What is the culture like in Japan with some of, because you always make a really good point when you're talking about the biometrics, and what you say is absolutely true, that it is global, it's all happening at once, and it's not an accident. And I have a hard enough time getting people to understand about national ID and why that's a problem, much less global. And so I'm curious as to what the Japanese and what the culture there, what they think about what's going on in the world.
Well, I love my Japanese friends dearly, but they're not known for questioning authority, generally speaking, and there isn't a great degree of political discussion happening on a societal level. There is sort of one of my Japanese friends called background politics. It's something that happens in the background, and you don't really talk about it in normal conversation with people, and it's just not something that a lot of people bring up. So unfortunately, it seems to be a country that is largely dominated by the media, and it's very easy for the media here to inject memes into the culture, and they're taken on pretty much wholesale by a lot of the public. And obviously that's a generalization, but it seems to generally hold true, and so that's pretty disappointing. And one of the things that I really like about Japan is that at the moment it is such a cash-based society, and they don't really use credit cards that much, and there's no such thing as checks or anything like that. Almost all transactions take place in cash, which
that's
is
awesome.
Great, but I can see them skipping over the plastic stage and going directly to the biometric RFID chip stage. I can see that happening very easily here.
We've got about a minute and a half here, and we've got a caller on the line, Rick from Texas. Rick, are you there?
Yes.
Do you have a question for Mr. Corbett?
Yes, one question I've never heard anyone address that claims that something other than an airliner hit the Pentagon. Where are the people that were on the flight you claim did not hit the Pentagon?
Did I claim that?
Well, you referenced it as one of the lies that were being told.
Well, actually, I believe what I said was that we don't have the actual footage of whatever hit the Pentagon, and I don't make a claim either way. I personally don't know.
It was something other than what we're told was hit it.
I think the point here is that there were 80 cameras in the area that had a vantage point of the plane hitting, and they won't release any of the. They've released two or three frames of those 80 cameras. And we experienced the same thing here in Oklahoma. Whenever we asked for footage of Timothy McVeigh getting out of the van, and we know the cameras were pointed at it, they said all the videotapes were being switched at the same time. I think that's the point that he was referencing.
Why don't we go ahead and carry this conversation on the other side, Rick? If you want to hold over, we'd love to carry it on. And I've got some to add to that from the Shanksville, PA perspective. And we found some similarities.
Okay, folks, we're going to go to break right now. We'll be back on the other side of this with James Corbett and our caller, Rick from Texas. You're listening to Radio Free Oklahoma on the Rural of Our Radio Network, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Radio Free Oklahoma on the Rural of Our Radio Network. Again, you can check out our websites at radiofreeoklahoma.net and wearechangeoklahoma.org. We're speaking with James Corbett, and we were talking to our caller, Rick from Texas. He had a question about the Pentagon attack during 9/11.
Yeah. Go ahead, Rick. You want to follow up on your question?
Well, I don't know anything about. I mean, I've heard your program before when you talk about what happened in Oklahoma City, and I really don't know anything about that. I mean, your evidence that you cite seems credible to me, but the fact that the government could cause what happened there, that the idea of that just seems incredible to me. But I hear so many people claim that a rocket flew into the Pentagon, and I've never heard any of them address where are the people that were on the flight that supposedly didn't fly into the Pentagon?
That's probably out of the whole, all the issues surrounding 9/11, and Mr. Crow, you might, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this too, is that seems to be one of the ones that everybody latches onto because there really isn't any official theory on that. I think the only thing that has been said about it is that the hole was not large enough for the plane that they said, and then beyond that, you know, you get into conjecture and things like that. I believe the more credible aspects of the 9/11 truth movement are centered around Building 7 and the licensed architects and engineers that have peer-reviewed scientific papers that show evidence of thermite in the dust of the World Trade Center. Now that building fell at free fall speed into its own footprint and it was not hit by a plane, and it was the third building to fall that day. In fact, just recently, Larry Silverstein, the man that owned the building, some information came out on Fox News saying that he was on the phone that day talking to his insurance company about demolishing the building because there were foundational problems in the building. Now, it takes 2 weeks to set up, a minimum 2 weeks to several months to set up demolition charges, much less in the middle of a fiery building on an event on a day where all these events are going on. So these are where people, I think, have honest questions. And when we get into some of the sides, theories about, no planes or, missiles, things like that, I think we kind of lose track of the credible questions that revolve around this event.
Absolutely. Let me chime in on that one because, first of all, I think my opinion about what may or may not have happened is absolutely of really no or more or less relevance than anyone else's opinion. So I wouldn't want anyone to take my thoughts as some sort of ironclad fact or something to be refuted. But what I'm interested in is the source documentary evidence that we have for things like this. And the point that I'm trying to make about the Pentagon is that they do have multiple camera angles that they have not released. And I find that interesting. Now, it could very well be the case that the Pentagon is a type of honeypot where they're inviting this type of speculation about the Pentagon so that one day they can release the tape and show, yes, it was the 757. Therefore, all speculation about 9/11 truth is therefore invalid. And that will be the type of straw man that they'll try to set up. So I'm in no way saying that I'm trying to say what did or did not hit the Pentagon. I truly don't know, and I think my opinion doesn't really matter. But the documentary evidence is what's important to me. But on the note of if this was not the plane, where are the people? That's an excellent question, and I think documentary evidence that we could point to as an example of how that might have taken place is something like Operation Northwoods, which is the declassified military plan that was signed by the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 1962 and put on President Kennedy's desk, and he did not sign it, thankfully. That would have seen the American government staging terrorist attacks to blame on Cuba in order to justify an invasion of Cuba. And part of the Operation Northwoods plan, again, approved by the Joint Chiefs of Staff all the way up the chain of command, right to the president's desk, involved taking planes, painting them up as commercial planes, switching off real commercial planes for these fake planes, and then blowing them up in international waters and saying that the Cubans did it. So in that case, the entire passenger list of the commercial plane that was to be sent up was going to be fake. It was going to be fake aliases of fake people, and the commercial plane was going to be switched off. So this isn't speculation. This is something that the U.S. government actually planned to do in 1962, and you can go and read those documents about the actual plans they had in place. So that's one way that an operation like that could be carried off. But again, I'm not saying that it was or was not taking place on 9/11.
May I offer something, James? As we were you were talking, I'm scribbling down 3 points. Excuse me. The first is the fact that Shanksville, PA, and I have this from a very trusted source that actually spoke with the medical examiner at Somerset County, where Shanksville is located. It's about 85 miles southeast of Pittsburgh, almost on the Virginia border, West Virginia border. 18 of the people that were allegedly on Flight 93 were found to be on the Social Security death rolls, which means they were dead at least for a year on Social Security rolls. And why in the world are their names on the flight manifest on United 93? That completely wipes out any credibility. This whole let's roll melodrama simply didn't happen. Second, in fact, there's an addition to that, step number one. The FBI, they found out through the medical examiner's office and some of the employees that actually had a lake house 8.5 miles away from the alleged shoot-down location, had FBI come by their house with bio bags. These are giant Ziploc bags, 4 to 5 feet in square. And they're asking the residents of this community on the lake to put whatever they find from the plane in these bags. And, oh, by the way, the FBI will be by the next day to pick them up. Unbelievable. It's like, why are they looking for evidence 8.5 miles away? That plane was shot down by the colors of... was it the Air Command out of Canada? It was an A-10 Warthog. The National Guard uses these planes all the time. They have the twin engines in the back. They're anti-tank gun planes. They're anti-tank planes, okay? So they shoot down the missiles. They're armor-piercing missiles. They blew the rear end out of Flight 93 out of the air 8.5 miles away from the shoot-down site. So whatever Dick Cheney and these guys tell you from the Pentagon is complete crap. And that's according to the medical examiner in Somerset County. Somerset County. Okay, the second point.
Down an airplane.
Pilot, go ahead, Rick.
So used an anti-tank aircraft to shoot down an airplane.
That's right. What is an A-20 or A-10 Warthog doing tailing a United 93 2 miles away?
I don't know, but that's not the plane you would use to shoot down an airplane.
Exactly. That's the whole point. But they retrofitted it out.
The reason that the other planes were unavailable was NORAD was actually going through an exercise that day. There is plenty of evidence that has come to light now with the actual audio tapes where they're saying, let's go ahead and cease the exercise inputs. Cheyenne Mountain's actually calling in that day. So at the same time that the attacks were happening, NORAD was actually going through an exercise of the very scenario of planes crashing into buildings. So they had multiple hijacked airplanes on their screens and as they were going through the train. And so none of the planes got scrambled. Now, prior to that, what was that? That golfer flew his plane too close. And they had they had fighters all around him. You don't enter airspace like that without being escorted by fighters. They were nowhere to be seen that day because NORAD was going through the exercise. Why were they standing down?
I spoke with a pilot with American Airlines, guys. When I first moved to Oklahoma City, I was flying all over the country doing research for the film and working on the Oklahoma City case. For a year and a half, I had free passes to fly pretty much anywhere I wanted to go. There was a pilot that bid a route from Oklahoma City to Dallas. He was dating a gal here in Oklahoma City, so we bid this route. I would see him at least once or twice a week. I finally pulled him aside on a jetway. We were coming in on the C terminal into DFW. It was a late-night flight. I had to hop a red-eye out to L.A., And we were on a first-name basis. And I pulled him aside. He had about an eight-hour layover in Dallas. And I said, look, this is the information I'm getting on the Pentagon case. And I just, maybe 2-3 minutes I was talking to him. He cut me off in mid-sentence. He says, look, I've flown a 757 for 14 years. I know every square inch of that plane. I know the hydraulics. I know the fuel allocation. I know the manifest. They have to sign off on the passenger list, everything. And before that plane actually pulls away from the gate, he says, there's no way, quote unquote, no way in hell that plane flew into the Pentagon because it would have taken out a good section of the West Wing. So, okay.
Well, Rick, we appreciate your call, and thank you for your listenership.
Was that the North?
Okay, we have another call online, Paul from Texas. Paul, do you have a question for our guest?
Oh, no, I was just kind of actually curious on that. What the last caller was saying was just like, about like, you think they just straight up didn't even actually have a plane that day? It was, you know, I mean, how hard would it be to make up a plane, a number, and a bunch of people that supposedly got on it, or do you think they just gassed a room full of people?
I believe that's the point that Mr. Corbett was making, that if that would, that could be a possible scenario, according to Project Northwood. Is that correct, James?
Right. That, so Operation Northwood's plan was to just paint up a plane like a commercial jet and have it as a drone fly out and explode. And that was what the actual U.S. government actually proposed in 1962.
So basically there was just any manner, number of things that could have happened. So you were just saying to stay away from that. As far as, because it was just speculation, right?
Well, actually, yeah. Well, the way I come down on this is that I think the physical anomalies of 9/11 are really interesting, and they're what get a lot of people thinking about it. But to me, what's so much more important is to understand the greater geopolitical context and the context of the players that were involved in the events on that day, and what was happening in the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, and finding out about PTEC and the software that could have been used to bring about this attack, and the $100,000 that was wired from General Mahmoud Ahmed to Mohammed Atta in the weeks leading up to the attacks, and all of these surrounding pieces of evidence that I think are paint a much, much, much broader picture of what 9/11 truth should really be focusing on.
Well, and even some honest questions like Transportation Secretary, was it Norm Mineta?
Yes.
Correct? Saying that the gentleman kept coming in, and this is his testimony. The Transportation Secretary's testimony saying that a gentleman kept coming in telling Dick Cheney that the plane that's about to hit the Pentagon, you know, it's 60 miles out, it's 50 miles out, it's 40 miles out. He said, do the orders still stand? And Dick Cheney turns around and says, of course they still stand. Have you heard anything different? Now, that's his testimony. That's something that should be investigated.
Not only that point, but the question of what time Cheney arrived in the Presidential Emergency Operations Center that morning is under dispute. The 9/11 Commission says it was around 9:50, and Mineta said he was already there when he arrived at 9:20. That's a huge discrepancy that exists in the documentary record. No independent media, no establishment media outfit has ever talked about that or questioned Mineta on his testimony. We Are Change, I think it was from Seattle, asked him about it twice, and twice he has confirmed that he says Dick Cheney was already there when he arrived. That's a huge and very important point to know whether the vice president was there directing operations when that plane was coming into the Pentagon or not. And that's a huge discrepancy that the media has never, ever inquired into.
See, and this is, they always want to take the attention off of these honest questions. Where are the camera? Why can't we not see the footage? And what was the answer to, you know, Normanetta's testimony there? Why can't we not ask questions about this? You know, everybody always wants to take it off into some realm that we can't answer. You know, I don't know.
Exactly.
I don't know if a missile hit or not. I wasn't there.
It's just typical. They take the weakest argument that's been made by anyone, and lots of people have opinions on this, and some of them are not as credible as others, and they take the weakest one and push that one.
And it's unfortunate. I'm even seeing this within the freedom movement of people that have a 30-year track record, like Tom DeWeese of American Policy Center, taking these little, you know, off-the-wall theories and saying that is the substance of the truth movement. You know, it's not. And those are the easy ones to knock down, and I think it's cowardly of a man like that to actually not address the real issues. We're coming up on break here. Folks, you're listening to Radio Free Oklahoma on the Rule of Law Radio Network. We've got kind of a heated discussion here about 9/11, but it's not going to be the focus of all of our interview. We'll be back in just a moment. I see the vultures. I see trouble coming. We're coming to a ball. listening to Radio Free Oklahoma on the Rural Radio Network. We have our call-in guest, James Corbett, calling from Japan. And if you want to call in and ask him a question, you can call 512-646-1984. I believe we have Joe back on the line. Joe, did you have another question for Mr. Corbett?
Oh, I sure do. Just a couple. You know, even before Northwood, you know, he talks about the geopolitical ramifications. That he's really hit it on the nail. But, you know, you have to remember, even prior to that, I mean, after World War II, you had military intelligence and others do what they wanted to do after the war. They wanted certain Nazi Gestapo scientists brought into this country, even though Truman said, you know, check all of these people out, and if they have any strong Nazi or Gestapo affiliations, I don't want them. So what did the military intelligence do? They doctored the files. The president didn't even know what was going on. And then, you know, when Kennedy became president, I mean, Eisenhower, he warned about the dangers of the military-industrial complex. With Kennedy, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, in which he was deceived by the intelligence community. And as a result, he fired Alan Dulles and Richard Bissell, who was in charge of covert operations. And as a result, he, you know, got murdered in Dallas. But if I could just digress a minute, I wanted to ask Mr. Corbett something about Japan. You know, I work for a company where we have been practicing Hojin and Kaizen, corporate Japanese philosophy, and it just seems to me, I'd like you to comment on this, that one of the problems when you try to indoctrinate Americans into that way of thinking is that, you know, the Japanese, as you've pointed out earlier, are unquestioning conformists. And in America, I think, when I think of what's American, I think of rugged individualism. So it really causes a lot of friction in the corporation as we try to emulate this philosophy that was originated in Japan. I just wondered if you could comment on that.
Well, yeah, I can only comment on it from my perspective as an English teacher here in Japan. So first in a private school, now teaching in the public school system here. And certainly, yes, I have experienced that directly. Even though I think that just naturally I tend towards the more Japanese sort of reserved style in my own personality, it's still sometimes very jarring to see the way that people are expected to conform to the system, whatever the system is in place. And the examples of that are absolutely rife in everyday life here, from the mundane up to the grandiose political scale. But just there's a system for everything, and there's a certain way to do everything. And if you want to try to do it in a different way, it really seems like it can blow people's minds sometimes that you don't want to conform to the system or the rules for doing something. So it's definitely takes some getting used to, and sometimes there are some things that you just have to accept is the way that it's done here, but it's quite difficult.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And of course, if they do deviate from the status quo and they're not rigid authority addicts, they, you know, quote, lose face. And I don't think we really have a word in English that corresponds to what they mean when they say, I've lost face.
No. But we do have the phrase, the nail that sticks up will get hammered down, and that's very much part of the education system here.
Right, right.
All right, Joe. Well, we sure do appreciate you calling in.
Absolutely.
All right, thank you. All right, Mr. Corbett, moving on here. One of the articles I think really stood out to me was When False Flags Don't Fly. I mean, that's picked up a lot of links from various sites. I know it was carried on prisonplanet.com. I went and I looked up the word terrorism in the dictionary, and it says the systematic use of terror, especially as a means of coercion. So terror being fear. So using fear to coerce people into what you want them to do. And I think that really applies to government, or, you know, when you see this, when false flags don't fly. I mean, you go through and list a history, I mean, all the way back to Nero, of false flags and how the government used them to benefit themselves.
Exactly. I mean, there's such a rife history of this that obviously for certain reasons we're not being taught when we're in school, but the history is there to be studied and to be learned from. And you're right, it does stretch back to Nero, and it cuts across every culture and every society and every period of history. And there's so many more examples that I could have included in that video. Even thinking about Japan when they were trying to escalate their involvement in China in the 1930s, so they pretended that the Chinese had kidnapped one of their soldiers in occupied China in order to cause an incident which helped to escalate and get Japan more involved in China at that time. And Hitler, obviously, at Gleiwitz, dressing the soldiers up, dressing detainees up as Polish soldiers and shooting them at a radio station along the Polish border as a way of justifying the invasion of Poland. And just time and time and time again, we see people doing this, staging attacks in order to gain sympathy for their cause, and gain hatred for their political enemies. And this is such an important tool to understand. And the more we can expose that, the more it's like a magic trick that we're telling the audience before the magician goes on stage. We're telling them how they do the trick, and that if we do that, then they cannot use that trick. So it's so important for people to educate others about this.
And it's interesting that you make that point, because I think that the underwear bomber, the man that saw him being taken on the plane by the well-dressed man, his very first radio interview I heard him do was like, I mean, it was like the day after, he said that he believes that there was a cover-up of the events of 9/11, and he said he was not going to allow that to happen here. So we are seeing our efforts, you know, have an effect on stopping future false flags.
Same thing with the vaccines. Right. The vaccines has been a miserable failure to get everyone to take them. And, you know, one of the things I was concerned about, and after a little bit of education, I wasn't so concerned about it, was to turn people off of taking those. And, you know, I'm curious to know what your opinion is now that we've got a little tiny bit of distance from that. On the pandemic, it seems obvious to me as I studied it that this little exercise of pandemic would serve a lot of political purposes and, you know, all sorts of things. But what is your overriding opinion on what all of that was about?
Well, it was something that there was so much hype at the time that it was almost difficult to cover, because it's difficult to see the forest for the trees when you're that much in the midst of it. But you're right. As we step back, I think I'm pretty happy with the coverage that I did on CorbettReport.com of that, because the first article that I wrote about it just as the story was developing was called "Swine Flu: Who Profits?" And it was basically about the various ways that some key political players stand to directly profit from the drug companies that they're invested in various ways that will provide the types of Tamiflu and other such drugs that were being proposed at the time. And then later on, I was talking about medical martial law and basically how the entire hype itself was being used as a way to pass legislation that would at some future time enable the government to institute medical martial law, whereby it will be easier for them to go around and force vaccinate people if they declare a pandemic. And now, of course, now we see that the entire investigation of the World Health Organization and the way it declared the pandemic in the first place, we see that the advisors who helped to make that pandemic declaration were themselves profiting directly from Big Pharma in various ways, various boards that they sat on. And now they are the ones that are heading up the supposedly independent committees investigating
exactly
why the WHO called the pandemic. So we see exactly what's happening.
I think that brinksmanship, I think, is a way to describe this, because they took us, all the legal mechanisms were in place to declare martial law. They took us right up to the brink without actually doing it. You know, the World Health Organization had to declare level 6. At that point, you know, Obama could declare martial law, or at a state level, each state could declare it. And we uncovered some documents here. We got a really good researcher that just tirelessly digs through all of the internet and finds these documents for us that said that it's through administrative law here in Oklahoma that a single person, the health commissioner, could detain you, forcibly vaccinate you, isolate you, you know, at
take
will.
Take your property without compensation. And that was one of the good things that came out of this little pandemic exercise, is that a lot of states, I know I'm not alone, we discovered that we had some really egregious rules and laws on the books that I don't know that we would have discovered otherwise. For instance, in Oklahoma, and I think this is true in a lot of other states, you might remember the Model States Emergency Health Powers Act that they managed to sell after the congressmen were scared to death over the anthrax. That Model States Emergency Health Powers Act, it was suggested legislation. And as far as I can tell, in Oklahoma, we have adopted just about every smidge of it, only it's not in statutes where you would expect it. It's been done through administrative rulemaking. And this is an issue that at least now we know we need to address.
Well, and we see legislation like H.R. 645, the National Emergency Centers Establishment Act, where they're talking about building these FEMA centers. And whenever our local reporter here, Andrew Griffin, called the state Oklahoma State Department of Health and said, where would you put people in case of a quarantine? They said the building down there that FEMA had put everybody during the Hurricane Gustav evacuation. So, I mean, we see these patterns there where, you know, there's no big sign out in front of that building that says FEMA concentration camp. But, you know, I mean, they're saying right there, if we're going to round you up, that's where we're going to put you, you know. I did a little video for that. It's on wearechangeoklahoma.org, our YouTube channel.
Did a really good job.
Scoop, very good scoop on that.
Well, right. And if I could just return to something that you were saying earlier, it is important for us to concentrate on the successes and the victories that we're having as well, because it's important not to just dwell on the negative things. But yes, we did manage to get the word about vaccines out in a big way. And now the WHO is actually fretting over how the internet ruined the pandemic because it made it worse by spreading vaccine fears and things. No, that's a success. And that's something that the media will never trumpet for us. We have to be aware that we had that impact and be proud of it.
That's right. And you have an episode that says 100 ways that we're winning, maybe that was the name of it.
Yes, episode and 100.
Very good episode. Yes.
All right, well, we're gonna come up on break here again. Folks, you're listening to Radio Free Oklahoma on the Rural of Law Radio Network. We're at the bottom of the hour. We have two more segments left, and we'll be right back after these messages.
No matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now. You're the renegades in this atomic age. This atomic age of renegades. You're renegades in this atomic age. This atomic age of renegades. Since a prehistoric ages and the days of ancient Greece, walked down through the Middle Ages.
Welcome back to Radio Free Oklahoma. We're talking with our guest, James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com. And we were talking about the pandemic, swine flu pandemic that was supposed to be so bad. And I think that you have a good point there that we got on the front end of that. And I think we really had some success there. We can't forget that type of stuff. And to have that gentleman, you know, point out the well-dressed man and bring to light all of the six different stories the FBI came out with, and he stuck to the truth the whole time. He only had one story. The FBI, we lose count of their stories.
You know, this is like, we pull it out of the playbook here from Oklahoma City. It's an old cliche with these guys. It is so worn down. It is so predictable that it's like, all right, if you're going to do this, at least you can pull some new tricks out of the book, guys. Why keep doing the same thing over? You're embarrassing yourself, not only because you're lying to us, but you just can't think of any other way to try to deceive the public. You think it works, and it doesn't. It's actually backfiring on them.
Right. Well, it has worked in the past, but it's not working so well anymore, and we're going to increase that understanding and awareness.
You had a segment called The 100 Successes?
The 100 Ways That We're Winning, I think, maybe.
Great. Episode number 100. I basically just wanted to spend a little bit of time doing exactly what I said before the break there, which is to celebrate the successes that we have had and are continuing to have, and obviously not myself personally, but just the entire collective alternative independent media movement that has grown up around things like Oklahoma City and 9/11 and other events that obviously we're not getting the truth from establishment sources. And if you can't beat the media, become the media. So it was focused a lot on that. And a lot of the poll numbers and other signs that we are really and truly winning the battle for the hearts and minds of the people in this, what really does amount to an info war. I think it's an apt term because we are absolutely engaged in a struggle for the survival of the species itself in a number of ways. I think we're on the brink of such incredibly transformative times that could be either obviously for the good or the bad, depending on how we the people assert our rights and take them back and basically take back ownership of ourselves. And if we can do that, I think we have an absolutely unimaginably wonderful future ahead for the human species. And if we can't, then we have just Orwell's vision of a boot stamping on the human face forever.
There's
and,
a quote.
I know which one I want.
There's a quote by Terrence McKenna that I love. It says, like it or not, the people of the fringe are in an apocalyptic struggle. Either the elite techniques of control will be perfected to the level where dissent can be abolished, or heretics will mutate to some level of consciousness where they can do the holy and miraculous works of resurrecting the dream of freedom for all.
Wow, that's a loaded statement.
That's so right. And please, people out there, please start reading Bertrand Russell and H.G. Wells and the Huxleys and people like that who really, truly did write about how they could manipulate and engineer humans to breed dissent out of them through various techniques. And this is something that the elite really have been writing about for decades and even centuries in some cases.
And why is it so hard to believe that people want to have control over others and that if they have the opportunity, that they will take that control? And James, you did a show, and I think you called it the Panopticon, and I was thrilled to see that because that is one concept that helps me to explain and understand the power of surveillance, of just being watched. And you also had another one called Newspeak is double plus ungood. And that's another good one, and it's referring back to Orwell's 1984. And you hit on a lot of issues there. You really have a broad range of topics that you cover. But even if I think it's something I won't be interested in, like something economical, say for instance, I think I wouldn't be interested in, I always end up listening and learning something from your episodes on CorbettReport.com.
Yes. Well, I'm glad to hear that because certainly even sometimes, even myself personally, a few years ago, I wasn't interested in economics fundamentally. But now that I've come to do the research on the real history behind the economic history that they're not teaching us in school, I suddenly start to realize, no, actually, this has been the central issue in American history that dominated American politics for the first 150 years. And now since the Federal Reserve came in, it's been completely and utterly removed from our general understanding just how central importance it is to decide who gets to create money and out of what and in what manner. And this was something that was so central to the political debate for decades and decades. And some of the greatest struggles in American history were between presidents like Ed Jackson or Jefferson and the bankers trying to set up their alternative systems for basically taking economic control into their own hands. And when you start to get into that, it is fascinating. It's truly interesting to read and hear about that. But of course, we've been taught that economics is this boring, dry subject that only matters to people who like math and statistics. That's
it's
absolutely
very social,
not true.
Sociological, I would say, now that I've looked at it some, and I have to give it up to Ron Paul for making the whole thing very easily understandable.
They use language that is so foreign to us that to try to hide it. And I always thought, I can't understand that. I'd have to go to classes on economics or something to understand it. And then whenever, like you said, Ron Paul explained it, I was like, that's it?
I know.
That's all they're doing?
I don't think I understand it.
They're ripping us off.
That debate, I'll never forget the
it's
debate.
It's counterfeiting.
Yeah, in South Carolina, he verbally dressed down all of his opponents. And even the moderator's like, okay, how do we respond to that? He simply said, gentlemen, we don't need to hire a whole law firm of legal experts and lawyers. Just refer to the Constitution. You're going to cut right through the chase. And it was a pause for about 5 seconds. I thought they were going to go to commercial break. He put everybody in their place. You have to break it down in the simplest of terms.
And another way that we're winning that you can see is the continued rise in popularity of Ron Paul and his ideas. I saw him on, what is it? Is it the Morning Joe or the economics guy? And everyone was listening very rapidly to what he had to say. And in a respectful way, listening
A year or two ago, they called him a kook, and now they're calling him an oracle. They're like, you've got visions, and how did you know the future? And
the host pointed out
levitating off the floor,
that in 2003 he said what was going to happen, and compare that to 2007 when we first started working on the Ron Paul campaign, and it's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing, and I would say I see lots of converts still to Ron Paul, and that's a good thing.
James, one thing I would. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say I had a recent podcast episode on Old Hickory and the Den of Vipers about Andrew Jackson's struggle against the Second Bank of the United States. And mm-hmm. At the end of that, I played a clip from Ron Paul talking about End the Fed. And I can't remember where it was, but he had an arena of 20,000 people chanting in unison, End the Fed, End the Fed, End the Fed. And
that would have been that. In
Minneapolis,
that's right. At the
Rally for the Republic.
Rally for the Republic.
Right. Yeah. And to me, that is the clearest sign that we are living in truly revolutionary times, and times that not only are revolutionary, but have the chance to be revolutionary in a fundamental sense. We're not just talking about taking up arms and shooting people. That's not going to solve anything. It has to be a revolution of ideas and ideology and truly understanding the system that we're in. And Ron Paul has done such great work in spreading that awareness.
We're on the precipice of a new renaissance, you know. I think we have to fall to the depths to see the contrast of the heights that we can rise to.
Well said.
One thing that I wanted to go back on, James, we're going to wrap this segment up here in about 3 minutes. Back in 98, I had a chance to fly into London and travel England for 10 days. I'll never forget getting off the plane after a 10-hour flight from Dallas and listening to the overhead speakers, and they're announcing these flights and trying to page people in 16 different languages. And it took me about 3 or 4 minutes to realize where I was. This is the gateway to the other half of the world. You don't hear this stuff in the United States. And that's an analogy to the media we have here. If people would just get up and shut their TVs off, get on the internet or whatever, just read about the other parts of the world to understand exactly how we're kept in this cubicle or
we have
this
a common
cocoon.
Humanity.
Exactly. And I'm not saying one world government. What I'm saying is you have to, it helps you look back at the country and how sheltered we are on the information that we get. And it's amazing, the reactions that we get. And having said that, that's a segue to, here you are in Japan for 6 years. You see what's going on in Japan and that society, but you get a whole different perspective on, I suppose, on how the media is treating us here in the United States and in Canada. What are your comments on that?
Well, again, I think it is important for people to step outside of that matrix in any way they can. And obviously traveling and seeing other parts of the world is an important step in that process. But you bring up the specter of global government. And I think actually the types of international connection that is possible now through the internet and through this technology, in fact, is a better argument for making more local forms of government. Because I think now we have the possibility of having community-based government or community-based organizations that now have the ability to communicate with others globally and to interact globally. We don't need these giant centralized governments in some faraway city that's going to tell us what to do. We now have the chance to truly build communities that can work and function as a community and also function globally. So that to me is an incredibly exciting time to be living in.
I fear that they're going to shut the internet down, because when I think of how that's opened up our ability to communicate. And I will say, in that sense, I do feel a member of the global community in a very good way, that I know people that whatever corner of the world they're in, and when something happens there, it really brings it home to me. It makes it very real. And I think that is a good thing, but I do fear that we're giving them more trouble than they're appreciating by sharing all of the information and connecting, and that they probably are going to do something to slow that down some.
You know what I think we should do? I'll be the first to suggest this on the air. We've got to get James on this network. We have to figure out a time frame. So, I mean, you'd be a heck of an addition to our Rule of Law Radio Network.
I think so, too.
James, we want to thank you for joining us. This is an honor taking the time out of your day in Japan. We'd love to have you back. So
we'll be working together in the future. We'll send you the information that we're bringing forward.
Awesome. Well, it's wonderful to be on. Thank you for having me.
This is the Rule of Law Radio Network. You're listening to Radio Free Oklahoma. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up our last segment.